Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Hi, it's David Freeman. I'm glad to be here with John Gertner, who's editor at Fast Company and the author of a fascinating new book called The Idea Factory, Bell Labs and the Great Age of American Innovation. Such a fun read, but it's also a great kind of fills in the gaps about the history of the information age, especially if you think that the information age began with Google and with Apple or even IBM, right? So welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a bit about Bell Labs to begin with. Bell Labs was owned by the AT&T and by Western Electric, is that right, back in the early days of the 20th century?
That's right, and it was a different AT&T than we have today. I mean, this was American Telephone and Telegraph had a kind of de facto monopoly over phone service in the United States, so it controlled 80-90% of the phone service in the U.S. And AT&T was sort of a mega corporation that it's almost hard to get our heads around what it was like. It was kind of a combination of Microsoft and AT&T today and Apple and Google and even a university all combined. But there were many different parts of AT&T. There was a manufacturing arm, there was a long distance part, there was a local service part. And in 1925, they decided they were going to kind of consolidate all of their engineering and science into one laboratory, one kind of mega industrial laboratory on a scale that hadn't really ever been done before. And the first, they called it Bell Telephone Laboratories, and the first laboratory was here, actually in New York City. And the idea was that this laboratory was going to both solve the near-term problems of this ever-expanding phone network, but it was also going to employ scientists looking for really new knowledge in physics, material science, chemistry, electrical engineering, and they were going to plan for the long-term communication needs of this phone monopoly. And they were going to employ new knowledge and sometimes maybe even solve problems that might be solvable on a time scale that's very different from the way we think of corporations today. They might be thinking in terms of decades,
right.
A new product that would unfold 20 years from the date that work began at Bell Labs. But in a nutshell, that's what it was. And really, this place of 3,500 scientists and engineers that started in 1925 eventually grew to tens of thousands of people with offices really all over the country.
So what was the world of telephony, I guess is the right word, what was the world of telephony about the time that Bell Labs was just getting off the ground?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent were people connected electronically?
Sure, I mean, it was very primitive. I mean, dial tones were at a minimum. Really, you picked up a receiver and you waited for an operator. It took an awful long time just to call long distance. If we go back to, say, 1925, to make a phone call from New York to San Francisco was incredibly expensive and incredibly difficult just to place the call to find, you know, what they called an open line. A lot of what Bell Labs did was create sort of these breakthrough products that I get a feeling you're going to ask me about in a minute. But a lot of what they did really, too, was to try to make this kind of clunky, sort of slow, expensive system faster, better, and cheaper. You know, how can we do things like direct dialing, which seems so obvious today, but was really like this miraculous development when it was created and unveiled, you know, where everybody had their own phone number. Because what this really was, if we go back, almost 100 years, if we go back 80 or 90 years, was where you really needed vast numbers of operators to actually implement that, and incredibly sort of clunky, kludgy machinery that would, you know, connect calls and had moving parts. It was very steampunk.
And so, yeah, I do want to ask you about some of the innovations, and perhaps I should have asked you that, mentioned that already. I mean, obviously, one, of course, probably the greatest innovation or the invention / discovery that took place there was the transistor.
Mm-hmm.
In 1947, but Bell Labs, and I'll ask about that in a minute, Bell Labs also involved in satellite communications, also in lasers.
Yeah.
What are some of the other kind of highlights of the big contributions to science and technology?
Sure. I mean, my book focuses a lot on innovations, which were, I guess I would define as products that were ultimately deployed into the system. There were a lot of discoveries made there, like the discovery of radio astronomy actually came out of Bell Labs.
Right.
I mean, it didn't really have any practical use for communications, but those were the kind of things where scientists there would write papers about it. But your short list was great. I mean, transistor, probably the greatest invention of the 20th century. It's in every electronic device we all use every day, whether it's an automobile or a microwave oven or a cellular phone or a laptop. laser, many of the early kinds of lasers. The whole idea of how cellular telephone networks work came out of Bell Labs. The whole idea of digital communications, which has really allowed for this world we live in of Google and Twitter and Apple and Facebook and sending information digitally rather than the old-fashioned way by analog waves. So those are, and communication satellites, and you know, I think those are a lot of, you know, those are some of the biggest really innovations of the 20th century. They created, they changed the way the world worked. They changed our lives. They created probably tens of millions of jobs and probably trillions of dollars in wealth.
Right, and I guess one of the important characters, there are a lot of fun, interesting, crazy-seeming characters in the book. A couple stand out. One is Claude Shannon, you alluded to before, who's got kind of the first one to think about information as being transmissible, I guess, or transmitted via binary code, zeros and ones, right?
That's right.
But let's back up to the transistor, because in the early days of telephone communication, that was dependent upon vacuum tubes, mm-hmm. correct? And those were tend to break. They couldn't go very far. The signal would peter out, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about the first efforts to make transcontinental calls or long distance calling more efficient. What was the technology story there?
I mean, I think it's interesting in the sense that sometimes what I think Bell Labs shows is that great innovations a lot of times, they do come from great ideas, but more fundamentally, they come from really big problems. And you're right, one of the biggest problems in those early days of telephone service was how do you get a call over a long distance? The way engineers describe it is that a phone signal will attenuate, it dies out over a certain distance. So you would need these repeater stations. They would literally boost the phone signal every 50 to 100 miles as a long distance signal was traveling across the country. And these depended on this technology, the vacuum tube. It was called the repeater tube within Bell Telephone. And those repeater tubes were in these repeater stations every 50 to 100 miles. And when you would call San Francisco from New York, your call would literally be sent through, you know, 10 or 15 of these repeater stations and boosted by this repeater signal, repeater tube, to make it across the country. I mean, in a way, it's like kicking a soccer ball down the field, you know, to make sure it makes it to the other side.
Right.
And really, this was a crucial technology to the phone company. However, there were some people at the phone company, including really a character who I think is probably the heart of my book, named Mervyn Kelly, who, even though they saw it as this miraculous technology that was essential to long-distance communication, also saw it as a kind of flawed technology.
Right.
That it used a lot of power, it broke a lot, it gave off tremendous amounts of heat, they were hard to make. And he was wondering if there was some other technology that could sort of take the place of these repeater tubes, or and not only to amplify phone calls, but to switch these phone calls, because that kind of technology is related. And in many ways, that belief that they had a flawed technology on their hands and they needed something better is what eventually led to the transistor. Because although the transistor can do many things, in its earliest and most fundamental incarnation, it was really seen as a replacement for the vacuum tube. This was going to be a tiny, low-power amplifier that would boost a phone call.
So this talk by, I guess, Mervyn Kelly gave a talk about this that inspired one of the key players here in the creation of the transistor, right, William Shockley.
Yeah.
And I think they tried a few, or he and some colleagues tried to make something work. It didn't work, and it was kind of put aside for a while.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that. They tried some, I don't want to get into much of the details, but they didn't have quite the right materials, right? We think of silicon and
right.
other semiconductor materials. They didn't really know about that at the time. So.
Yeah, I Mervyn Kelly made this speech to in the office of William Shockley and said, you know, we should get all the tubes and switches out of the system. Can we build something that will do it a solid, you know, material that will take the place of these things? They didn't have the right materials. I think one thing that's interesting is Bell Labs is probably like the right institution with the right scientists at the right moment in time, because although it had these brilliant physicists and communications engineers, it also had this brilliant group of chemists and metallurgists.
Right.
And in many ways, the kinds of things they were tinkering with allowed for this revolution that eventually happened afterwards, not just in communications, but in computers and computer chips. And there were a group of people at Bell Labs who were working with a new kind of materials, silicon and germanium, a class of materials called semiconductors, and they were just starting to understand them. And that was, in many ways, the key to making the transistor and making so many of those post-war technologies and computer technologies work. They found out if they kind of used extremely pure mixtures of extremely pure creations of silicon and germanium, and then just used the slightest impurity, they could get the kind of devices that they were looking for.
So this first, the first time I guess they demonstrated that this worked, it was a big eureka moment, I guess, right, in the lab. And that prototype is still, I think, in the museum at Bell Labs right now, right? If you want to go see it, where is that?
It's in New Jersey in what was known as the Murray Hill Laboratory, which is in a town called Berkeley Heights in northern New Jersey.
So there were three scientists who worked together, and probably the most colorful of those was William Shockley, who went on, who I guess was a very driven guy, very opinionated guy, mm-hmm. and had some kind of crazy ideas about racial purity or something, tried to link race and intelligence.
That's right.
So what happened to him after the story of his incredible invention? Well, tell us about how that played out
sure.
the rest of his life.
The transistor, for one thing, they had the invention in 1947. It was unveiled in 48. It really took a few years before they could even manufacture it. And even then, its impact wasn't quite felt for many years. I think it kind of gives you an idea of how long it takes for a real breakthrough innovation to happen, because this idea Mervyn Kelly had in 1925, it probably wasn't until 1955
right.
that it started to make an impact on culture. Now, at about that time, Bill Shockley, who was one of the three inventors of that original transistor, in fact, he even came up with a better design for transistors than the original. It was improved. But he began to feel unappreciated at Bell Labs.
Right.
He's not a terribly sympathetic figure. Very brilliant man, very quick-minded. He could be a lot of fun. He could be delightful company, powerful intellectual, but also sometimes a bullying presence.
Mm-hmm.
Decided that he was going to make a fortune. He saw, probably before very few, if anyone else saw, that this was going to be the next great kind of industry, that somebody could make, as he put it, $1 million, you know, making
right.
transistors. Nobody thought of making $1 billion. And he went to the West Coast. He found some funding, and he was going to set up the first transistor company in what became Silicon Valley. Bill Shockley brought the silicon into Silicon Valley,
right.
as we talk about it. And he set up Shockley Semiconductor. Shockley was a great scientist. He was a terrible manager. He was very difficult and unpredictable and almost paranoid with his employees. He was very good at hiring people, and his company eventually imploded. The people who worked for it got up and left. They eventually became known as the Traitorous Seven, is it, or Traitorous Eight?
Mm.
And they went on to form the Intel Corporation and other illustrious things in Silicon Valley. But Bill Shockley is kind of this tragic figure in many ways. Although, as I said, he's sort of unsympathetic, and certainly his racial views make him even more so, because he was really convinced at the end of his life that the human race was somehow imperiled by our genetic inferiority, you know, by a race of genetically inferior, less intelligent people.
So he became kind of a eugenicist, I guess. I don't think you covered this in your book, but he did, I think, go on to start a sperm bank for the Nobel laureate seed, so that you could.
He did. You know, I don't know if it's in the book, or it might be in the footnotes. That's
yeah.
right. That's exactly right. He did. Believe that of course, like many megalomaniacs, you know, who see great problems with the world, he feels that he's the solution, you know, and so he donated a sperm to a sperm bank of geniuses, thinking that he was going to help save the human race.
Do you know, did that idea die with him? Do you know? And when did he die? Do you know?
He died did he die in the, you know, it's in the book, and it's been a while. I'm going to say in the 80s, early 80s.
A couple of decades,
okay,
at least.
Yeah. So, I believe Slate did a follow-up on some of the sperm bank for geniuses, but I don't really know. It's been some years since I've read the follow-ups and what happened to it. But, no, I don't believe that he's spawned any other geniuses, so to speak.
But it's interesting, too, because all the men, I believe, profiled. There are a few women, but they seem to play very secondary roles. Mm-hmm. They all seem to be kind of the stereotypical white male scientists, right? So what, you know, to what extent did, I mean, obviously, I guess Shockley's ideas were more extreme, but did Shockley's ideas were mirrored to some extent on a very, I mean, I don't want to say Bell Labs racist, but were there blacks, were there women working seriously as scientists there? Were there any official policies about that?
Sure, no, it's a great question. In that early era of the 30s and 40s, it was a white male bastion. And oddly enough, Bell Labs was much more progressive than the parent company of AT&T, where there were deep strains of anti-Semitism and racism, mm-hmm. and it was literally impossible to get a job if you were Jewish or black. Their views on women were only slightly more enlightened, allowing them for
assistance or
yes,
something?
Yes, I mean, support staff. Right. Bell Labs moved into that area. I would say certainly in the wartime, women began to assume a sort of a basic leadership role in some aspects. The mathematics department was much more progressive than some of the other departments mm-hmm. at Bell Labs. And I think there's a fellow in the book, Bill Baker, who became the head of Bell Labs, really research division, which would be the basic science division within Bell Labs in the mid-50s. And Baker was very progressive about bringing women in, and eventually African Americans too by the early 1960s. I don't think it didn't really become, I think, truly diverse until the 1970s.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's unfortunate. I'm sure that there were many great people who were overlooked. And in fact, many Jews felt that way a couple decades earlier, mm-hmm. that they couldn't get a job at Bell Labs in the 1930s or 1940s, which is kind of incredible. But
right. Well, let's talk. I want to ask you some more about the history of Bell Labs. But what I want to talk about, one of the other kind of most more striking figures, I guess, the most striking figure other than Shockley in the book, who's Claude Shannon. Mm-hmm. And you describe him as kind of an extremely eccentric guy. Was he an exact contemporary of Shockley, basically? Did his best work in the 50s, is that right? But you, anyway, you describe him as extremely eccentric. He's juggling, he's riding his unicycle up and down the halls. He's doing, I think, both at the same time at some point. But tell us about him and about where this, you know, idea came from and why it was such a transformational idea that he had.
Sure. Some of the people I write about in the book are Shockley was a physicist, Mervyn Kelly was a physicist. Claude Shannon was different. He was really trained as a mathematician and an engineer. And he kind of came out of nowhere, like a lot of people at Bell Labs. He grew up in a small town in northern Michigan. He was eccentric. He loved playing with machines. It almost seems, you know, I say he was like a man so far ahead of his time in many ways. Like there's now the maker movement, you know, mm-hmm. there's people playing robotics. I mean, Shannon was doing that 60 years ago, which is fairly surprising, I think. But he came to Bell Labs right during World War II and started working on cryptography. He, at that point, was kind of regarded by most of the people who had met him as a sort of quiet genius. Mm. Unlike a lot of people at Bell Labs, which was a very collaborative place where people were actually encouraged to work in groups, you weren't penalized in any way by getting another name on the academic paper you were writing. You know, the more the merrier. You were always trying to bring people in, right. oftentimes, to your work. But Shannon liked to work alone. I mean, he was really this prototypical kind of lone genius. And at some point in the mid-1940s, he began to work on this idea that all communications essentially could be thought of the same way. That until that time, there was a very sort of firm conception that radio was one thing and telephone was another, transmissions and television, which was just emerging, was still another, telegraph was yet another. But Shannon saw it more kind of philosophically and conceptually, that every kind of pursuit was trying to send a message in a kind of noisy world and trying to make sure it's received accordingly. And as I mentioned before, most electronic messages were sent through these analog wave signals. But Shannon very much believed that the future was in sending messages digitally, either, you know, by binary codes, zeros or ones, which could stand for letters or numbers. And he eventually, in the late 1940s, formulated something that became known as communications theory. Later, still, it became known as information theory. And it sort of governed the idea of how to send any message electronically from one place to another. And what he did was he set down a kind of theoretical framework for how messages could be sent and how messages could be sent accurately. And Shannon's work on that really became a kind of basis for any message we send today. Mm-hmm. They talk about Shannon limits on how much communications channels can hold and error correcting codes, which kind of make sure that you can send a message without an error. It's one reason why if you put a scratch in a DVD, it'll still play correctly because it has extra bits of information that can make up for that error within it. All right. Kind of goes back to Shannon. So in many ways, he sort of saw the future of communications as being digital rather than analog, which in itself was just this huge, huge leap. It took many years before the actual system made that leap. But in many ways, he was somebody who was a kind of oracle, I think, and it's probably a pretty good word for it. Somebody who was consistently 20 or 30 years of ahead of his time.
And although he, so this is one of the key, I guess, pillars of the information revolution, right? This basic, his paper and his ideas were kind of the key, one of the key pillars. And yet, Bell Labs lost out, you might say, right? They didn't build computers, they didn't go and exploit this in some way. And I think that was the case with a lot of technologies, right? They were a monopoly, they exist at the pleasure of the Justice Department, basically.
Yeah.
So, and then also, that was also the case with other technologies, right? There were some missteps, important missteps, about things that were, for example, the picture phone. That's, you know, before where there was Skype.
Right, right.
There was the picture phone, which was, you know, again, like these scientists, was ahead of its time, right? So what were some of the other things like that, the picture phone, and what are some other great successes? You talk about cellular telephone service and so on. So just quickly, if you could run down some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I think cellular telephones is probably a pretty good example of something that was far, far ahead of its time. You kind of gain an appreciation, or at least I did researching this institution, of how long sometimes it takes a good idea or an invention to really become part of the culture. You know, I talk about an innovation as having both impact and scale. That, you know, what is an innovation? And that's really hard because we sometimes kind of, I think, mistake invention for innovation. And if you look at the idea of cellular phones, the kind of key plan or breakthrough for how you create a cellular phone system was laid down by an engineer at the Bell System named Doug Ring in 1947. And 1947 was actually this amazing year for Bell Labs. It was when the transistor was invented. It was when Claude Shannon was writing his information theory. And it was also when this rather obscure engineer was kind of creating literally almost a diagram of how you set up a geographical area to be served by these low-power antennas that would handle phone calls as somebody was in motion, maybe driving in a car from a cell to another cell, you know, a cellular area. They didn't use the word cellular at the time. But this idea almost literally just sat on a shelf for literally about 20 years before the Bell System could actually use it. And in part, it was technological. In part, they needed computers and certain kinds of advances to actually make that system workable.
Right.
But they also needed some regulatory changes, too. And you had mentioned before that you know, the Bell System didn't get into the computer fields and these other areas. Why didn't they? And you're exactly right. They had these kind of agreements with the federal government. They were allowed to have this monopoly in telephone service, but they were expressly forbidden from getting into the computer or other electronic fields.
Right.
So they could build anything for phone system or data communication, or they could do military work on contract, but they couldn't get into these other areas. And so they were heavily regulated in that sense, and the phone the idea of expanding phone service to something wireless was something that was really kept at bay for many, many years by the Federal Communications Commission.
Another thing you mentioned very briefly, and we've got to finish up pretty quickly here, but You talk about why cellular telephones don't have dial tone.
Right.
Do you have an explanation for that? Because I think people don't really think about that so much. The dial tone is such a ubiquitous thing in our lives, going back many decades. I don't know when it was invented.
Yeah.
Do you know when dial tone was created or when it was first used?
The dial tone was, I think, first used in like the 20s and 30s, but it really became much more prevalent in the 40s and 50s.
And the reason for what's the reason for the dial tone and what's the reason for dial tone?
You have an open line, you have an open circuit, you can dial, literally.
It's an old way of alerting the user, right?
Sure, exactly.
Good to go.
Exactly. If you're under 25 years old, probably you might not even think about dial tones as sort of normal. But yeah, that was a very conscious decision for the people who were creating these cellular telephone systems, and I think it's late 1970s, maybe early 1970s, rather. They were trying to think, should a cellular phone have a dial tone? And they decided, no, it should not. And they picked two reasons, actually. One is that when you have a dial tone, you're connected to the network, and the less traffic the network has at that moment, the better. So you don't have to be on there. And of course, the fact that they didn't do a dial tone has allowed for the kind of print out a message and then send it for all these text messages that we rely on now. I mean, it's very fortuitous that it happened as it happened.
Right. Yeah. So. There's some other things that Bell was involved with: lasers, with fiber optics, which it lost out, but Corning and others took over that kind of creation of the pure glass fibers that made that long distance telecommunication possible with fibers. Let me ask you, just kind of summing up, because where is Bell Labs? I mean, Bell Labs, ultimately, the Bell system was broken up by the order of the Justice Department, mm-hmm. right? In 1974, it took about 10 years. 1984 is when the Bell kind of splintered into different things.
That's
Bell
right.
Labs still exists, right? It's in kind of an attenuated form. How would you describe it?
Yeah, very, very much attenuated. It's really part of, it's probably Bell Labs in name only. It's a smaller group of engineers who do, I would say, applied engineering and some research for a company called Alcatel-Lucent, which is one of the big telecom providers in the United States, actually global. They're still located in New Jersey, but their main office now is Paris. Alcatel-Lucent is a kind of merger between the French telecom giant and Lucent. But as you said, many parts of the Bell system splintered off long before this. It's just that the Bell Labs name has been retained within Lucent, where engineers still work on creating better telecom equipment.
And so is there an inheritor? What's the closest thing to the Bell Labs in its heyday that exists today?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think Bell Labs was still a little different, both in terms of its size and its mandate and its monopoly, than almost anything that exists today. Which is not to say there aren't some tremendously innovative companies that do fascinating work. I mean, probably the closest thing we have might be Google, mm-hmm. and Google has a research division within it that does very, very far-reaching projects called Google X. We know about Google Glass and the self-driving car. Apparently, they're doing a lot of work in robotics that they're less inclined to talk about.
Right.
And, certainly Google has a certain amount of market share that allows it to invest money in projects that so far, at least, its shareholders are not complaining about.
Right.
I think the question is, if Google has a bad year, then, can it justify spending money on some of these things?
Well, I wonder, just kind of summing up, what would the people of Bell, the scientists of Bell Lab in its heyday, and the executives in the heyday, say in the 50s, what do you think they would make of today's telephone system? I mean, I think the one thing that they were very interested in was the quality, the fidelity, the sound fidelity mm-hmm. of the system, right? And as you point out in the book, that I think they maybe misjudged that people were worried too much, that the consumers would be put off by clicks and pops and hisses and all that.
Right.
And of course, we're all used now with cell phones. We're very comfortable with, you're fading, you're breaking up or whatever.
Right.
So what would those guys make of today's telephone system and the information revolution?
I can only speculate about the people who passed away. I mean, I did have that conversation with people who were older who were in their 80s, for instance, even in their 90s, who'd worked at Bell Labs during that 1950s heyday. And most of them were really quite amazed, you know, astonished, really, at just the size and elegance of the iPhone, for instance, what it could do, how powerful its processing speed was. You know, I think they had, it was not something that, you know, I was going to say it was not something that they had foreseen. Some of them had foreseen that, that we would walk around with pocket computers or pocket phones, but to seeing it and imagining it, I think, are two different things. So, you know, I think a lot of the people at Bell Labs were very far thinking, but in many ways, I think it has, I think that information revolution, that ability to kind of incorporate or integrate communications of all kind into one miraculous handheld device. I mean, obviously not just the iPhone, but any kind of Android phone, any kind of
smartphone
indeed, is still astonishing. I mean, you know, I write about technology all the time. It's still astonishing to me. And I think in that sense, it has outpaced our expectations in many ways.
Well, thank you so much. Really a pleasure to talk to you. I've been talking with John Gartner, who is an editor at Fast Company, a former editor at the New York Times Magazine, and also author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs, and the Great Age of American Innovation. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, David.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robinhood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.